This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Companies are not living up to their retirement promises. I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today on the show, the cold realities of shrinking pension plans across corporate America. In the past, the scenario has gone like this. You work most of your adult life for one company, and in retirement, your earned pension repays your loyalty by taking care of you through old age. Well, today, many of those pension agreements aren't worth the paper they're written on. On Reporter's Notebook later on, a conference on climate change kicks off today in Montreal. Controversy comes in as the U.S. does not want to comply with international emissions guidelines. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. Changes in bankruptcy laws have made it easier for companies to shed pension obligations. Employees have lost the power to sue a company to enforce retirement promises. Some bankruptcy legal experts foresee the day when literally every business in America will try to dodge retirement plans. Coupled with escalating health care costs, will the loss of retirement pensions turn millions of retirees toward poverty instead of security? On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, the United Nations begins a 10-day conference on climate change in Montreal today. The U.S. will be represented, but the administration has made it clear that it will not agree to a new long-term international standard of emissions reductions. But first, this news. Saddam Hussein's trial for alleged crimes against humanity was postponed today until next week. It's a volatile climate for a trial, to be sure, as two of Saddam's defense lawyers have been assassinated and a plot to kill the judge has been revealed. Joining us now from Baghdad is Howard LaFranchi, who's the foreign affairs correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you, Mr. LaFranchi, for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Dana.
Well, let's first of all talk about this sort of instability in terms of conducting a trial. I mean, we mentioned, the assassination of two defense lawyers, but the way I understand it, that the time of the trial is never revealed, the actual starting time day to day, just to make sure that, you know, that's nebulous. In the front row, there's a warning sign in both English and Arabic. If you sit here, you could be on television. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, how this trial is being conducted, and it can, in fact, be a fair trial.
Well, in fact, that's the argument of the defense, that in fact it cannot be a fair trial in Baghdad, in Iraq, and they'd like to have it moved out of the country. But the prosecution argues both that it can be a fair trial and that it's important for Iraqis to see this trial taking place in their country, that justice can be done as they build a new democracy. Of course, that does not rule out some of the violence related to the trial that you've referred to. Not only the killing of a couple of judges, a couple of defense attorneys, another one injured simply left the country. But this morning there were a couple of mortar rounds exploding right before the trial. It's hard to know if that was related. If that was an attempt at some kind of a sign, but certainly it keeps things jittery as the trial proceeds.
And so you're saying, besides the courtroom itself, there's a feeling on the streets, both pro and con Saddam.
Well, yes. There were, I didn't notice any today, but yesterday and on Saturday, there were, in fact, demonstrations on the street, peaceful demonstrations, but from a Shiite community here, really calling for the trial to get on with it. Actually, the people were demanding Saddam's execution, which could be his fate if he were found guilty. On the other hand, of course, Saddam has the support of a number in his own Sunni community, and which is of course where the insurgency lies. And you referred to the uncovering Sunday of the plot against one of the judges. And that, allegedly anyway, according to a document that was found, was ordered by the strongest remaining member of Saddam's governing team, the highest member who still remains in in freedom.
Mm-hmm. We're just curious, I think, as Americans, to see Saddam Hussein taking quite a bit of time, anytime he wants to address the court, to address the judge. I mean, today he erupted with admonishing the judge that, he doesn't ever want to, what happened to him today, having to climb up stairs, not having any paper and pen being afforded him. But he lectured the judge, telling him, I don't want you to tell them they can't do this. I want you to order them. And is he just allowed, is anybody allowed in an Iraqi court as a defendant to just stand up and start lecturing the judge?
Well, I think in this case that the judge is trying to be careful to recommend or to recognize all of the defendants' rights. Remember that there are those who are arguing that these defendants, because it's not just Saddam, but it's seven of his cohorts from his regime. And the argument of the defense is that they can't get a fair trial. So I think we must remember it's a brand new jury system, judicial system. I'm sorry, that's being formed here with a very high profile case, and after all of the former president. But you're absolutely right. There are those, especially in the Shiite community, who are saying that it's starting to look like a farce, and that it's looking like Saddam is, in fact, in control of the court. And,
right.
and there
Mr.
are those
LaFranchi,
who are saying...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we thank you so much for that report, and we'll be back to you in Baghdad in future days, I'm sure. We'll be right back.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. From the airlines to the automakers, the dream of clocking in for 30 years and then reaping the retirement rewards for the rest of your days is in serious decline. Millions of workers expecting health and retirement benefits will instead get nothing or close to it. As giants such as General Motors and United Airlines grapple with financial disaster, slashing their pension funds is one of the first steps they take towards solvency. Time magazine, in a recent cover story, reports Congress has created legislation that makes it easier for companies to drop out of their retirement obligations. The Bush administration is pushing for a vision to put retirement savings, health care, and even Social Security directly into the hands of the employee. The ownership society is evidently upon us. We're joining us today to start this conversation, and it's such an important one in our day and time, is Jim Steele, who is editor-at-large for Time magazine. He's been an investigative reporter for 30 years, and I mentioned the cover story at the moment on pension plans. It's the Time October 31st issue. Mr. Steele, thank you, and congratulations on the comprehensive nature of this article.
Well, it's very nice to be with you today.
All right. There were so many hard-hitting, gritty stories about individuals who had and have put in, all their time and wound up with nothing. And I certainly want you to recount a couple of those for us. But I tell you what, let's go to the big picture first. Just give us an idea. I know it's a hard thing to get wrap one's arms around in a couple of sentences. But what kinds of pension plans are being dropped out there? What is the shift going on from defined benefits to defined contributions, if you can?
Well, that's actually a very good place to begin, because what's happened over the last 20 years, it's been a gradual transformation. If you go back 20 years ago, the the pension plan that was more and more popular was the so-called defined benefit plan. It was the gold standard. These were the ones that corporations paid into over a period of time. An employee retired after 25, 30, 35 years, there was a guaranteed benefit at that point. Money was set aside, or at least that was the theory of it. But beginning about 20 years ago, as 401ks began to become more popular and corporations saw certain benefits there, they began to pull away from those defined benefit plans, put more money into defined contribution plans, and principally 401ks. It cost the companies less. Now, you'd hear the argument that 401ks were great because they were more portable. But obviously the same kind of thing could have been done with defined benefit plans if Congress had wanted to do that, if we'd wanted to take that step.
And I'm sorry, just to interject, more portable meaning that the sort of profile of the workforce has changed. You don't really stay with a company much 30 years anymore.
Some don't, and certainly portability would have increased that. And this was one of the arguments for 401ks. But the fact of the matter is, you know, millions of workers over time thought money was being set aside for them in these pension plans. And now they're coming to this sort of bitter finding at the end of their careers. They're finding out, no, that money never was set aside. No, the health benefits that they were promised by their employer, in many cases take early retirement, that those are being taken care of. Death benefits, insurance, a whole range of things that people thought were going to be there at retirement are turning not to be the case. We make the point in the story that it's the same thing as that if you went in and put $1,000 in a bank and said, okay, and the bank says, we're going to pay you X amount of interest for 10 years, and you went back after 10 years, not only did you not get your interest, but they said, gee, your $1,000 is not here, and in fact, we only have $200, or maybe we don't even have that. How would most people feel if that happened to them? But that's exactly what's happening to many retirees in this country today.
Well, I mentioned before that there are so many absolutely gripping emotional stories that you and your colleagues recount in the story. Can you just briefly, not to take a person's entire life and the tragedy of losing their pension so quickly, but go through either the woman from Polaroid, any one of them is just shocking.
The woman from Polaroid is a perfect example of this. I mean, Polaroid was a company of many white-collar, upper-middle-class workers, and employees began willingly paying 8% of their salary and wages into an employee stock ownership plan. When the company began to hit hard times, the company sponsored or company appointed trustee ended up selling these shares for basically nothing. So people who had $200,000, $300,000 in savings built up for their retirement as an adjunct to their pension, all of that was lost. We wrote the story of Betty Moss, a woman outside of Atlanta who was a regional manager who had worked for the company for 35 years. She loved the company. She gave up her pay for many years, 15 years or so, to fund that, only to find out at the end of it that nothing was there. And the amazing thing that happened to her, which is happening all over the country, is that when some of these companies enter bankruptcy, as Polaroid did, employees find out that they basically have no status in bankruptcy. The companies that provide the money, the banks, the lenders, they have the priority. Employees basically get nothing out of a process like that. So somebody who may have given years of their earnings and so forth, when the expectation that they're going to get that wind up with basically nothing.
Well, you're bringing up so many things, lawmakers, Congress, how this all happened. I want to get to that and even some history. But let's take the senior management. You've just painted a very poignant picture of an employee at Polaroid. I think if memory serves me right in your article, the stock went from $60 a share to 9 cents. Is that true?
That's correct.
So 9 cents. So obviously someone and this woman you're referring to was expecting something in the neighborhood of $200,000, wound up with almost close to absolutely nothing at the end. Now paint the other side, the senior management at a lot of these companies. How are they being impacted by these cutbacks, or do they skate out just fine?
Well, this is one of the surprises that Don and I had in doing the research on this. Unbeknownst to us, in many corporations, there is a special pension plan for the very highest executives. So in the case of Betty Moss, for example, who didn't even get the retirement savings for the year she'd actually worked, it turns out in many corporations, boards of directors will actually reward executives who retire by giving them credit for years they didn't even work. I mean, our current Treasury Secretary, John Snow, is a perfect example of this. Snow worked for many years as head of CSX Corporation, the largest rail operator in the Northeast. And when he retired, he took a lump sum pension of $33 million. It was based on 44 years of employment. But when he looked at the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission financial records, come to find out he didn't actually work for the railroad that long. He only worked for them for 24 years. But the board of directors unilaterally gave him 18 more years of service, which inflated his pension by several million dollars.
So they can literally gift years of service not worked.
They can gift years of service, and it turns out this is not an uncommon thing in corporate America. So on one hand, you have the employees out there losing benefits that they have spent much of their life working for, which they thought they were going to get, and ending up with nothing or certainly substantially less than they thought they'd get, versus the executives who end up getting pensions for years they didn't even work.
All right, let's break this down and find out how this all happened. First of all, what mechanism, what laws are companies using to be able to so easily break their pension plan contracts?
For one thing, Congress did not insist that companies really keep current with their contributions. I mean, that's the main thing with pensions they didn't do. So
enforcement was the first issue.
This was one of those things, totally legal. There's nothing illegal about this. They just didn't do it. A second thing which Congress didn't do, which Congress did do, which turned out to be very detrimental, back in the mid-90s, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which insures pensions, used to publish a list of the 50 most underfunded pensions. And this would shine the spotlight on those companies that were not keeping current with their contributions. Well, none of those companies liked that. They didn't like the publicity. It led to annoying questions by their workforce. Are we really going to have our pensions? So they and many other companies lobbied to eliminate that list, at least to compel the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation not to release that information. They were successful in the mid-90s. And a couple of years thereafter, PBGC stopped doing that. It turns out many of the companies that lobbied, like Bethlehem Steel, which said this was terribly unfair to them, of course, are now out of business and have totally transferred over to the federal to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation their obligations. So, you know, that was something that at least was a form of enforcement. It was shining the light on those funds that weren't performing properly. Once you take that light away, like a lot of other things, it meant the pension plans could operate in secrecy. The PBGC might know they were in trouble, but they had no way to really publicize that information on a specific basis.
And you know, everything you say brings up another 10 questions. The PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, the way I understand it, too, they're supposed to come in and now be the salvation if General Motors, which is on the hot seat right now, cannot come through with their pensions. Well, they've got this agency, this government agency, the PBGC, who can come in and save everybody. But the way I read it, back in 94, already the PBGC was in a deficit of something like $31 billion. Today, they've hit a deficit of $450 billion. So who are they going to be bailing out?
You're unfortunately reading this just right. In fact, when they dropped the underfunded list that we were just talking about, the deficit then was, as you were saying, $30 billion. And supposedly everything was fine. And, of course, we see it up to $450 now. And the huge problem here is that it really actually does penalize the way this is set up, the good corporations, the ones that have made their contributions, because there's going to be more pressure on them to increase the premium paid to the federal government to cover those companies that haven't lived up to their end of the bargain. And as a result of that, there's going to be an awful lot of pressure on companies to kill their defined benefit plans, their gold standard pensions, and shift to those that are less costly to them. So it's all part of a spiral that you see going on. As companies pull further and further away from this, the PBGC has fewer and fewer resources to cover the pensions that are going to come due. So there's a real train wreck coming down the line at some point in the future on this, and we're either going to have to increase, either there's got to be a bailout or more corporations are going to have to pay for these, but one way or another, it's not going to be a very pretty picture.
Well, you know, the way you put it also, one of the paragraphs in the Time article ends, it says, we are literally returning to 100 years ago when individuals assumed 100%
of the risk of their retirement, that corporations will not be involved whatsoever anymore. Is this a good or a bad thing necessarily?
Well, we think it is probably not a good thing for the population, for citizenry as a whole. The great thing about a defined benefit pension plan is it provides an economic foundation for people. And the 401k, which is didn't even exist really 20 years ago, has now passed, 401k accounts have now passed in value defined benefit plans. And there's nothing wrong with 401ks, and we don't criticize them in the story. But we make the point they are never going to provide for the average American worker employee the kind of retirement that a defined benefit plan would. The money just isn't there.
All right, wait, hold on a minute. Will you, Mr. Steele, and thank you, first of all. We really set us off well today. We'll bring you back in. But I want to go to Stephen Moore, who's a senior economic writer for the Wall Street Journal, has written a book called Government, America's Number One Growth Industry. Mr. Moore, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Let's get your – we got to go to break in a couple of minutes, but get us started on the benefits of a defined contribution and 401k-type program. What are the positives on that side?
Well, first of all, I think that you all are right that the economic foundation of the old-fashioned defined benefit programs really have broken down, and the discussion you just had is exactly, you know, why we're moving away from those plans, because you have big companies like General Motors and the airlines and Adelphi that have made these pension promises that they simply can't keep. And so what you're seeing and what you've seen over the course of the last about 20 to 25 years has been, as you were just discussing, a shift away from the defined benefit plans to plans that are more individually directed, that we call defined contribution plans, where you put in a certain amount each month, and the individual worker has more say about how that money is invested, where it's invested, and how they can take it out when they retire.
But what has been the history so far with 401ks, where especially when people don't stay at that company, as we said before, that model's changing for 25, 30 years. They work for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and when they leave, they don't use the 401k often as a retirement. They just cash it out and start all over, so they're not doing as well on a long-term basis for retirement with the 401ks. Is that not true?
Well, I think it's the opposite, that under the old defined benefit plans, you had to sort of stay with the company you were with for a certain number of years, whether it was 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, until you got, quote, vested.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were sort of chained to their – and we all know people like this who were in that position who said, I can't quit this job because I would lose the pension benefits that
sure.
I built up. And so, the American labor force has changed so dramatically over the last 20 years. I mean, it's almost as if we're a nation of free agents where every worker is working for certain numbers of, the average – stay with a company now is 4 or 5 years, where it used to be 7 or 8 years. And so we are much more mobile in terms of the kind of companies we work for. Also, by the way, I should add that a lot more workers are self-employed now than used to be the case. And this new kinds of pension plan, which is where you put money in and either the government matches the funds or the company you work for matches it, I think is a kind of economically liberating idea that's
all
catching
right.
on.
This is Stephen Moore from the Wall Street Journal. Jim Steele from Time Magazine is with us as well. And Sean O'Brien, Assistant Policy Director at the AFL-CIO, is going to join us in a minute, too. We'll be back in just a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're talking about companies leaving their employees high and dry by bailing out on their pension programs. And with us on our program at the moment is Stephen Moore, who's the senior economic writer for the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Moore, you were sort of painting a picture for us a minute ago that just, corporate America, all of the economics in America has changed so radically that those original, altruistically founded pension plans just aren't working. But I'm wondering, on an economic economic analysis, and that's what you do specifically. If the late 90s was a time when the stock market, you know, just waffled, right. Inflation rates are low.
Right.
So we've got a bad time for any of these companies keeping up with funding their pension plans. What if we, you know, got a great stock market boom again and inflation rates go up and pension plans are healthy again? Is it cyclical, or we just really need to go toward privatization?
Well, I think the idea here is that, you know, for the individual worker, it gives that worker more control and more, and I think actually greater security. And it's really up, I think, to the individual worker whether they want a plan where their retirement future is really dependent on the company they work for, or whether they want that money put into a sort of a personal account that they control, so that if they leave the company or if the company goes bankrupt, at least they still have that money in their account. It can't be taken away from them the way you were just describing when companies go bankrupt now. They just tell the workers, you know, you're out of luck. You put it paid in all that money, but we squandered all the pension funds. So a lot of this is really based on how much control of the money the individual worker desires.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to Sean O'Brien now, who's the assistant policy director at the AFL-CIO, focuses basically on retirement issues. Mr. O'Brien, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Diane.
What about these 401ks and privatization in general, going all the way up to Social Security privatization, which has been, you know, a big push in the Bush government? Are these good replacement ideas in terms of getting rid of defined benefit retirement accounts?
We don't think so. And when we think about these issues, we think about it broadly as retirement security and how do you build retirement income security for working families.
Mm-hmm.
And a traditional way to think about this and how we think about it is you need Social Security, you need a pension, and you need retirement savings, and which, by the way, members of Congress have all three of those. And that's what union members try to get at the bargaining table. So that today, if you just look at the private sector, 4 in 5 private sector union members have a retirement plan on the job, and the overwhelming majority of them have a traditional pension. Part of the concern about 401ks and similar defined contribution retirement plans is if you look at the actual experience with them, they're really not doing the job. So, for example,
in terms of long-term retirement.
That's right. They're not delivering the retirement income. So, for example, if you look at people who are closest to retirement, and this is based on some numbers published by the Federal Reserve Board, if you look at families who are closest to retirement, so 55 and older,
mm-hmm.
40% of them don't have any retirement savings in a 401k, an IRA, or similar plan. And among those who do, so among the 60% who do, the typical person has just $55,000 in it. And that translates to between $250 and $350 a month in retirement income. Now, compare that to a typical pension for somebody receiving a pension in the private sector. You have an average pension benefit of about $600 a month.
Okay. So I guess you're really sort of breaking it down. The nuts and bolts of it are, is that an individual, it sounds good. You know, I want control of my destiny. I want control of my future. But when it comes right down to the investment performance of individual by individual, it's not easy for people to manage the money for that long a term.
Well, there are a whole host of issues as to why these plans are not working. And there's something interesting going on in Congress right now. Congress is looking at the plans and recognizing that they really aren't working. That although, you know, everybody has put choice up on a pedestal and said 401k plans are all about choice, Congress is looking at the plans and saying, well, we really don't like the choices that people are making. So that's why we're beginning to see legislation come down the pike that would default people into certain investment options, default them into participating into these plans. So there are all kinds of things like that Congress is exploring, because the bottom line is these plans are not working.
Stephen Moore, come back with us, will you? Senior economic writer for the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Moore, let's go back to the company's point of view. What is the pressure, and perhaps you could use the GM Toyota analogy here. What is the pressure on a company today in this market to drop their defined benefit pension plans and become more competitive again in the international market?
Well, I think that's a good question. And what we're seeing now with, for example, the decline of the U.S. auto industry. Hopefully it's only temporary and we'll see a comeback. But one of the factors behind this is that a large percentage of the worker compensation is no longer just the salary. It's health care benefits, pension benefits, all sorts of other kind of fringe benefits. And, you know, the joke around Detroit these days is that, you know, GM isn't even a car company anymore. It's a healthcare company that just happens to make cars because mm-hmm. their healthcare costs have become so expensive. And so what I'm saying, and I think a lot of other economists are saying, who look at the competitiveness of American industry, which we all want to see, is maybe it would be better if our companies really concentrated on making the products they're supposed to make, whether it's cameras or cars or software, and healthcare and other types of things like pensions that we're talking about were really up to the individual where they could join group associations or so on. I mean, I would say one thing in response to these figures about the small 401k plans that people have, which is the explanation for why those accounts are so small is that most workers have only had those accounts for, you know, 5 or 10 or 15 years. So as this new generation of workers come in and they have these 401k plans for 25, 30, or 40 years, they will build up and people won't have $50,000, but hopefully $500,000 or more in these accounts, and they'll be able to have a pretty secure retirement.
But Jim Steele, would you come back with us, editor at large for Time Magazine? And we've mentioned a couple of times today that Time has a cover story, very hard-hitting cover story on the October 31st issue on this particular subject. Mr. Steele, we can talk about, you know, the past. We can go way back. We can go way back to, you know, before World War II as to why pensions were first instituted. Then we can look way ahead in the future, go down 20 or 30 years and discuss how privatization might work. But what about, you know, your article points out that, you know, the aging baby boomer today is going to be left in abject poverty. A lot of those people, women. So what's going to happen to this middle group? And it's not going to be a short time, and it's not going to be a small number of people who are being dropped from their pension plans.
Well, the point I think needs to be made here about these 401ks, which is related to your question, is that whether you save in these for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, the fact of the matter is, 401k plans are never going to provide the return for the average employee out there that a defined benefit plan does. I mean, that's just the numbers are just there. And that's the other thing to mention. The reason that corporations adopted these 401ks was not to make things better for their workforces because their workforces were more mobile. They adopted these simply because they cost the corporations far less than defined benefit plans do. So that's the thing to remember here. And the net result of all of this down the line is that people in their later years are going to have, not everybody, but a substantial number are simply going to have fewer resources to take care of themselves. I mean, just basic things from housing to food to clothing to all of the things you have to deal with. You know, it's interesting. Mr. Moore was just talking a couple minutes ago about health care. I mean, the easiest way this country could solve the health care problem for General Motors and Ford would be to adopt a health care system like Toyota and BMW have abroad. I mean, they have national health programs which deal with these costs, which take them off the table for the corporations. That would make GM and Ford in this country immediately competitive.
And are those expenses taken off the table by the government, by the national government?
They're national health plans. And
that's a big juggernaut right there. I mean, how long has Congress been facing, you know, revamping our health care system?
Well, you got to remember that this country took us 65 years to adopt Social Security after Germany. So we work on these things on a very slow pace. But the fact is, if we wanted to deal with health care, that would be the easiest, simplest way to deal with that cost issue, certainly for large corporations. I mean, right now we spend substantially more on health care than any other industrialized country in the world. And a lot of that cost does fall on just these exact corporations.
And then, when you bring in health care costs inflating year by year, but the pension numbers don't, it maybe we could if we pushed health care over to the government and made pension back to, you know, the auspices of the corporation, that the pension plans could possibly survive.
Well, the thing that's also interesting, there was so much emphasis this year on problems in Social Security. The irony is the worst problems in the retirement system out there are not in Social Security. They're in this whole private arena. It's not just the loss of defined benefit plans, but the fact not enough money is going into 401k plans and other things, and the fact that health benefits are being canceled increasingly for retirees before 65, those are major issues sweeping the country, and they're far more severe than whatever's going to happen down the line with Social Security.
Sean O'Brien is still with us, Assistant Policy Director at the AFL-CIO. Mr. O'Brien, let's go into this argument that companies it's just dollars and cents. They cannot stay competitive. They may even just have to go bankrupt. A GM possibly will face that. You know, if they also carry all the costs associated with pensions, do you buy that argument?
No, and I think it's important to make the point that, I mean, we were talking about health care a minute ago. Health care really is a different ball of wax. It's an area where we've had double-digit cost inflation year after year. And in the case of pensions, what we've seen is we have part of the business cycle here and part of the financial market cycle. A lot of the pension underfunding that's been reported in recent years is really the result of what some people are calling the perfect storm of a big decline in the stock market. So you have assets and the plans drop, and really low inflation rates, which have driven up the reported value of the benefits that have been promised.
They drive up the liability for the company, right?
That's right. Yeah. And so you had this growing gap with shrinking assets and growing liabilities that were all a result of financial market conditions. And as I mentioned, some people are calling this the perfect storm or the 100-year storm, because we saw for pension plans really the worst financial market conditions since the Great Depression. So part of what we're seeing is going to go away in time as equity markets improve, as interest rates change. For example, you mentioned that the PBGC deficit is $450 billion. Actually, it's only $23 billion. Still a big number, but far cry from $450 billion.
That's just direct reporting. How can you go from $450 to $23 billion?
The $450 billion number is a number for aggregate underfunding in the entire private pension system, right? Sort of a snapshot of that. The $23 billion is for the PBGC itself. And that number is really based on, that's another snapshot based on current market conditions. If interest rates, which are used to measure the pension benefit guarantee corporation liabilities, go up, that alone would shrink the size of that liability. Now, it doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything about it.
Yeah, it's still not a pretty picture.
$23 billion. But we really need to put it into perspective. So, the vast majority of companies, even with underfunded plans, they're in good shape. There are other companies who are facing financial market troubles. We mentioned the steel industry and the airline industries and what happened in those industries. And they're really, the termination of those pensions was a symptom of larger troubles in those industries. When the steel industry, much of the trouble driven by trade policy, and in the airline industry, driven in large part by the aftermath of September 11th, the effects on travel and soaring oil prices, fuel prices for the airlines.
So it's almost you talk about sort of a temporary shifting situations. Are you not so terribly concerned about the future of pension plans of retirees for the workers of America?
Unfortunately, we have a long-term trend of companies dumping pension plans. I think Stephen mentioned that over the last 20, 25 years, we've had the share of the private sector workers covered by traditional pensions has been cut in half. It used to be 40%. Now it's down to about 20%. And that, at the moment, there doesn't appear to be anything that's stopping that trend. And in fact, it may have accelerated as companies try to get out of the pension business because they'd rather go to cheaper 401ks. One recent example of this is over the summer, a very big company, Hewlett-Packard, decided to close its pension plan. And when it did that, it didn't simply say, we're getting out of the pension business. They said, we're going to go to a 401k and contribute even less money to the plan. Mm-hmm. So, and provide, in effect, they're providing lower benefits to workers. So it's not simply that companies are saying, these plans are more expensive to run, they're saying we're going to go to a plan and deliver less retirement security for people. So we are very concerned about that. We're very concerned about the choices that Congress and the president may make that may drive companies out of the pension system even more.
All right. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Moore, Stephen Moore, come back with us, will you? Senior economic sure. writer for The Wall Street Journal. This is probably going to be a terribly remedial question, but I have to say
I like
that,
those.
Okay, you like it? This will be easy for you. I can't understand. If a company does not file Chapter 11, how can they be allowed? It looks to me like a contract. When I work for a company and
right.
I sign my contract, how can it just be, poof, dissolved in thin air?
Well, that's not such a remedial question. It's a tough one because in most cases when companies liquidate their retirement funds, they actually do – the sort of easy way out is to apply for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And I think my point is, you know, there's kind of a contradiction in this discussion because in the first 10 minutes of our discussion, we all talked about how so many of these corporate defined benefit programs are going bankrupt, and,
mm-hmm.
and these ladies have lost all their money in the funds and so on. And at the same time, people are then making the case that these are better plans than defined contribution plans. So, you know, we can't have it both ways either. And one of the reasons that companies are going getting rid of these plans or can't pay them is they have made promises they can't keep. And so I guess my point is that it makes a lot more sense to have a plan where actually you control the money yourself, where it's in your own bank account, even if the company you work for goes out of business or goes into Chapter 11, you still have that fund even if you lose your job. And I think that's one of the reasons why more workers are feeling more comfortable with this type of plan. I'm pretty bullish on the American economy and on the market, and I think we're going to see a future with the stock market very much like the past, where, you know, the average real rate of return in the stock market has been about 8% per year after inflation. And if people have a safe, balanced account over the course of a 25, 30, 40-year work period, they will retire with a pretty hefty retirement income.
They really could come through over that kind of period of time with something similar to what they would have had with a pension.
And yet the point is that they will have real security in that, because even if the company tries to walk off with the pension money, they can't do it because it's in a private account.
It's your money. All right, Jim Steele, we started with you. Let's finish with you today. Jim Steele, editor-at-large for Time Magazine, been an investigative reporter there for 30 years. Mr. Steele, you know, I mentioned in the beginning I wanted a little bit of a broad sweep of history. So, you know, we've just heard Stephen Moore from the Wall Street Journal say basically that, you know, it's got to be one or the other, and that, you know, it's been a false dream almost, these pension plans. It's been unrealistic goals. How did that come about to start with? Was it just a prognostication that was off of the stock market?
No, I don't think it has been an unrealistic dream. Now, some companies have gone belly up and have gone bankrupt. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But many others haven't, and many others have tried to provide these pensions. But what's happened is, as people saw the appeal of the 401k and similar kinds of instruments like that, they began freezing pension plans, shifting a portion of the contributions they were making into 401ks. I mean, the idea of being able to have your money to take it with you, it sounds very, very appealing. And if people like that idea, then they'll be very happy with what the future is going to be. But the point we're making in the article is that while this will be great for a small percentage of people, this will not be great for the average American out there. They're going to have fewer resources. They're going to have less to retire on. And it's going to continue to exacerbate the gap between a small percentage of people at the top of America and everybody else. I mean, even Alan Greenspan is now talking about the gap in wealth in this country and what's causing it, and the fact that in any democratic society you can't sustain that. So this is a severe problem, and we think the direction we're going will merely increase that, will exacerbate it.
Well, we thank you very much, Jim Steele. Again, cover story, Time Magazine, on the October 31st issue on the loss of pension plans. Thanks for all your time today.
Nice to be with you.
All right. And Stephen Moore from the Wall Street Journal, Sean O'Brien, one of the policy directors at the AFL-CIO. We thank all three gentlemen today. I dare say a topic that affects virtually every one of us in America today. On Reporter's Notebook, in just a minute, a United Nations climate change summit begins today in Montreal, but the U.S. does not plan to support the conference targets for cutting emissions. We'll be right back with that and more of To the Point from PRI.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Kyoto Agreement on restricting greenhouse gas emissions went into effect last February, but the U.S. was one country that refused to ratify Kyoto. Today, the United Nations convenes a 10-day climate change conference in Montreal, and greenhouse emissions will again be center stage. But the U.S. administration insists they will set their own emission standards and refuse to follow international guidelines. Joining us on this topic is Martin Mittelstaedt, who's an environmental reporter for the Globe and Mail, which is, of course, a Canadian newspaper out of Toronto. Mr. Mittelstaedt, thank you very much. I assume you're in Montreal?
No, I'm in Toronto right now.
Okay. Well, is it fair to say what I said, that the greenhouse emissions, you know, will be the topic of discussion for the next 10 days?
I think it's going to be the topic, the preeminent topic at this UN climate change conference. They've got some side issues to deal with, but the main issue is figuring out what the world is going to do next in terms of controlling greenhouse gases.
And, before we get to the politics and the different countries, et cetera, I wonder if you would just give us a basic course. You're an environmental reporter on greenhouse gases. Is it carbon dioxide emissions?
The worry over the greenhouse effect is coming from carbon dioxide emissions, mainly from the burning of fossil fuels. There's also a couple of other gases like methane that are a fossil fuel as well. The concentrations of these are building up in the atmosphere from human activity, and the concern is that we're kind of double glazing the planet, going to heat the place up and cause just incredible dislocation and hardship for the people if this continues. More extreme climate events, that sort of thing.
Double glazing the planet, that's quite an image. And I suppose then you are saying that in the scientific community, I'm reading some of Princeton University's Michael Oppenheimer's comments, is to say we're heading toward a very critical time, that this warming trend will have irreversible consequences. Is that pretty much the standard thinking in the scientific community?
That's the standard thinking in the scientific community. I think there's almost no doubt that global warming is happening. I think there's some question over how extreme it will be, but the general trend is clear. There's virtual scientific certainty. There's more debate in the United States over this because the government has refused to sign Kyoto, but the vast international consensus is in favor of believing that climate change is real and it's happening now.
Can you explain to us why the United States is so resistant? I mean, certainly the Bush administration has spent $20 billion on climate change programs, so it's not like the United States is doing nothing. But why don't they agree with the Kyoto Agreement and beyond?
I think that they are concerned about adhering to any international treaty. I think that your listeners and you yourself are aware of where the ideological background of the U.S. government is. I think they want to distance themselves from any international regime. It's not just climate change where the U.S. Stands apart from the rest of the world.
It's a bigger political picture, and I realize...
It's a bigger political picture. I think the U.S. Government is more influenced by oil and gas and coal industries than some other governments of the world. I'm sure that's an issue.
Mm-hmm. And, I know that you're Canadian, but I think you can, I'm sure, comment on this. I read that, for instance, our governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson, if he doesn't go himself, he's going to send a delegate up to Montreal. And so, there are states in the United States that, regardless of whether we ratify the Kyoto Agreement or the agreement that will come following in 2012, they can do what they want statewide,
I think that there's a great division in the U.S. over this on whether it should be outside of this international treaty to control greenhouse gases. It's basically the only game in town. And many states and many municipal governments have decided that what your U.S. federal government has done is wrong, and they're moving ahead to to at least shadow the thinking on Kyoto. I think California, for one, is very far advanced with its some of its policies, like automobile efficiency standards being raised, and certainly the mayor of Seattle has started a movement within the United States to have municipal governments endorse Kyoto, and it shows that the U.S. isn't of one mind on this.
What's the report card at the moment on the countries? And I understand that the U.S. and Australia were the only of the industrial countries who didn't ratify. What's the report card out of Europe and Asia of the countries who did sign? How are they doing on bringing down those emissions?
Well, the countries are all over the map. Canada's record is actually pretty bad, but it's partly because we're so close to the U.S. and export so much energy to the U.S. Our emissions have risen quite sharply since the Kyoto deal was announced. The U.S. has a little bit better record. The best records in the world are in Eastern Europe, countries like Russia and some of the Soviet satellite states.
Is that right?
And they've had a huge drop in greenhouse gas emissions that occurred in the early 90s when their economies collapsed following their sort of anti-communist revolutions.
Yes.
And so they've had huge one-time reductions. The other countries that have done well have been countries like Germany and England. They've had very large greenhouse gas reductions by doing things like investing in alternative energy sources. You know, wind power comes to mind. In Britain, they converted a lot of their coal-fired power plants to natural gas, and that natural gas burns much more cleanly.
Okay. So Martin Mittelstaedt, I'm sorry, but I think we're going to leave that conversation there for today.
Okay.
Appreciate your time.
No, I appreciate it.
Environmental reporter for the Globe and Mail. Today's program was produced by Christian Bordahl with Jonah King, Karen Radziner. Technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.